listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me, once again, Alistair McLeod. And let me, before I forget, to tell you, you should make a point of going to goldmoney.com every Thursday and look for Alistair's latest commentary. He writes every Thursday, writes an in-depth market commentary that I frankly don't feel I can be without. And you, when you get to Gold Money, go to the Gold Money Insights link and then click on the research page, and it will take you right there to not only Alistair's latest, but as I was looking at it this morning, goes all the way back a long way as you can pick up articles that he's written over many weeks and months into the past. Alistair, thank you for joining us again.
That's very much my pleasure, Jay.
I'd sort of like to focus on your October 7th missive, the funding challenges ahead. My goodness, it seems like they don't get less, they get worse and worse, and more expenditures by this government, for sure. And I can't say it's more of a Republican or more of a Democrat issue. It seems like every president spends more than its predecessor. At least that's been the case in the last number of presidencies. And so we're running these huge deficits, and how will they be funded? That's the issue. I think maybe we're approaching something like $30 trillion now, Lester, the U.S.?
Yes, that's right. Unimaginable numbers, and there's no sign of it stopping. And, you know, with President Biden being a Democrat, he's under a lot of pressure to continue spending beyond what can be raised in taxes. And not just him. I mean, the same was true of President Trump. It just seems endemic, actually, not just in American governments, but also elsewhere. The deficits around Europe, particularly in the Mediterranean states, are really mind-boggling. Of course, the UK also has deficits, and we're going to get a budget tomorrow when our young chancellor is going to try and sort of close the gap a bit between what the government actually raises in revenue and what it spends. But we'll see how that one comes out. But I think your point is well made, that the deficit is a fixture, and unfortunately it's getting larger. And the assumptions from the Congressional Budget Office are that it will sort itself out because the economy will start growing. The most recent indications are that it's sort of running into a brick wall a bit, because you have things not being supplied or not available, and the truckers have still got COVID, whatever it is, for various reasons. After the initial wave of post-lockdown spending, the economy seems to be sliding to some sort of halt. So I think that it won't be terribly long before the CBO has to revise its estimates of the government deficit upwards. I think the baseline for this current year is around about $3 trillion. I suspect it will be somewhat more than that. It's a problem, and how to fund it. That was the purpose of the article, which I read back earlier in the month. Yeah,
exactly. Well, I think it was the Atlanta Fed earlier in the year were predicting something like a 6% GDP. I know you don't. GDP is another topic that you've talked about, and not a big fan of GDP accounting, but nonetheless, it is a measure that we use, and they're looking at something like 0.4%, down from 6%. I don't know what the congressional budget people are basing their numbers on, but if it's 0.4%, I dare say that alone will add, will reduce the amount of tax dollars that go into the Treasury and increase that beyond that $3 trillion area. And then we have, of course, looking at real growth, we have to subtract inflation. And then we have a very troubling, I think 5.4 was the official CPI number, the last one, something like that. I know you also are very skeptical about the true inflation rate as opposed to what the government's telling us. But in any event, this can't, as you say, can't get better with these kind of dynamics, huh?
Well, that's right. And I mean, your comment about me not liking GDP and not liking the CPI inflation rate. I don't like any government statistics. I mean, mm-hmm. quite frankly, they are either irrelevant or unbelievable. Mm-hmm. I think there is one use for GDP, and that is for government and government alone, because GDP is a guide to the government as to how much tax revenue they're likely to achieve. What it doesn't tell you is anything else of value. And, you know, unfortunately, of course, you know, government and universities and, you know, the investment industry have all succumbed to Keynesianism, monetarism, or, you know, modern monetary theory, if you like, more recently. So they actually don't know anything about economics. Economics in the sense which it originally was, which is as a social science, turning it into, using statistics to turn it into a science, a natural science like physics or chemistry or something like that, is completely inappropriate. And it's hardly surprising that, you know, after finally getting rid of the last vestige of money from the currency system, which is what Nixon did in 1971.
Right.
You know, that we're sort of just gently sliding into a crisis, and that slide is no longer being gentle. It's getting into the sort of quite a rough ride.
Which seems so, right? I mean, another term that you don't like is stagflation, I gather, because I saw that. I didn't get a chance to read the article, but you and I lived through the 70s, and well, at least in the United States, we had this very serious stagflation. What was called a stagflation, we had an economy that was declining and costs of living was going up very sharply. That I know is true. Call it what you want. And that seems to be where we're headed now. But what do you think? The mainstream doesn't really want to attach, I guess it's this Keynesian economic theory, that doesn't want to attach monetary growth with inflation. And they're blaming things that you sort of touched on a moment ago, that like, you know, supply chain disruptions and COVID, people staying home and that sort of thing. The notion is that it's transitory. It will only last until those things get rectified. But in fact, I don't know, to what extent do you think those are legitimate reasons for the rising costs, and to what extent might it be just an awful lot of money that's created, or would it be the case if there wasn't money growth, prices couldn't go up as they are?
I mean, basically, the root of the problem is the production of currency by government and also by the banks. But the one that we rarely notice is government. Banks, when they produce money by expanding bank credit, what tends to happen is it's a cycle. So, you know, what they expand at one stage, they get to a point where their balance sheet is bearing too much risk. So they decide, you know, for various reasons that they need to reduce their risk. And so, you know, the bank credit tends to contract. But the base upon which it operates, which is central bank currency, is expanding. And so if the base is expanding, the effect of it is that much greater over time. But, I mean, when it comes to prices, if they stopped printing money, as the euphemism is, then you wouldn't get a general alteration in the level of prices in any dramatic sense. And that is now what we're seeing. I mean, we saw a massive expansion of the Fed's balance sheet last year. And, you know, this is a situation which is sort of continuing, though it's a bit confusing with reverse repos, mm-hmm. sucking out liquidity and all the rest of it. But the fact is that the root of the problem has been money printing or the expansion of central bank currency. And if you didn't have that, some prices would rise, but basically they would rise because resources would be shifting from other things towards mm-hmm. those items. Mm-hmm. Other items, if you like, would find that they're either not needed or their prices are just downwards and to a certain point where they are needed. So the thing sort of balances out. I mean, you'll never get a complete balance, but it sort of balances out. Mm-hmm. I mean, the difficulty, I think, that the public faces is that they see prices rising. And, of course, for each price, there is a specific story. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, look at natural gas. I mean, natural gas this week has gone through the roof. I mean, it really has. It's up another 13% on the week, I think.
Wow.
Mm. And we can say that the EU hasn't authorized the opening of the Nord Stream 2 gas mm-hmm. pipeline. Mm-hmm. Or you could say that Putin has turned around and said, I'm going to restrict the amount of gas going to Europe so I can drive the price back. Yeah. You know, whatever you want to believe, the Chinese are saying they are desperate for gas. And they have told their electricity generators, go and buy gas and coal in the international market. It doesn't matter what it costs. No one is going to shut down factories because of lack of electricity. So, you know, you've got a specific story there. But mm-hmm. behind it all is that if gas prices rise, which they are doing, governments, insofar as they're affected by it, will make finance available for the people who are suffering. So, you know, there is absolutely no break on the price rises. And, you know, it was as Milton Friedman, is probably his most famous quote, you know, that inflation is a monetary phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And it is. But you can't translate accurately, mathematically, if you like, a change in the quantity of currency in circulation into a predetermined price effect.
Right.
It doesn't work like that. What right. is far more important is whether people actually want to, you know, the degree to which they want to use a currency in exchange for goods. Yeah. And, they got no option in America but to use dollars. But mm-hmm. one option they do have is to hold no dollars. Now, if they hold no dollars, then the dollar has no value as a medium of exchange. And so it is, if you like, that human factor which, you know, Keynesians, mathematical economists are just completely unaware of or just don't understand. Mm-hmm. It's that human factor that really drives prices against a background of changes in the quantity of currency in circulation.
Now, it is that definitely that idea that each individual has a choice to make. And, of course, Milton Friedman, we could sure use a Milton Friedman or two around these days. But the idea that each individual has a choice, and it's a collective choice of individuals, not the government telling everybody they have to behave the same way, which tends to be, I think, the thought process of the Keynesians. And they think they can put us into their models, and, you know, everybody's going to react the same way. It smacks against the idea of individual freedom, which is so much a part of our culture, at least it has been up until now. But let's get to the question of who are the contributors to the U.S. I mean, who are the financiers? What segments of society can buy U.S. treasuries? You go into that, your October 7th article, and you mentioned there's the financial, non-financial, private sector, there's foreigners, and then there's the Fed. Talk to us a little bit why Uncle Sam can't really depend on the financial and non-financial sector so much, and why it'd be foolish to continue to believe that foreigners are going to be kind to us and keep buying treasuries and lose money in the process.
Yes, I think probably the most important potential variable in this is foreigners. Mm-hmm. Foreigners, according to the U.S. Treasury's tick figures, already own nearly $33 trillion worth of financial assets and bank deposits. I think something like a bit over six trillion of that, is bank deposits. But so they're already very much invested in U.S. treasuries, corporate debt, and also equities. I mean, there's a very large portfolio element. I think from memory off the top of my head, that's roughly 14 trillions worth. Mm-hmm. The U.S. Investment in financial assets abroad is significantly less than that. So if you have a situation where everybody repatriates their funds back into their home currency, there will be very substantial net selling of the dollar. I mean, that is clear. The problem I think that the foreigners will face is that as inflation, price inflation, if you like, picks up, and when it becomes apparent that it's not really going to just stop at 5.4 or maybe even 6% or something like that, but actually go further, then there will be an anticipation of rising interest rates. It will be inevitable, because if you're going to hold on to dollars as a foreigner, you're going to want compensation for the loss of its purchasing power. So, you know, irrespective of whether the Fed decides to head this one off at the pass and raise interest rates to support the dollar, the fact of the matter is that, you know, falling asset prices, financial asset prices, starting in the bond market, and incidentally, it's worth having a look at the chart on the U.S. Treasury 10-year bond. I mean, that's how... Technically, it looks like it's about to, but you know, the yield is going to shoot up. I mean, there's a bit of a resistance at 1.75%, but after that, there's nothing stopping it going on up and up and up. So this is a very live issue. Just put yourself in the hands of a foreigner. If you own U.S. treasuries, you're going to see falling prices for U.S. treasuries. You're going to see portfolio losses. You're going to see a Fed who will be reluctant to raise interest rates because the economy is slowing down. So what do you do? You're going to, if you're a private sector investor rather than a government, because when it's government to government, you know, you've got politics involved.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
We'll exclude them. But when you're a private sector investor, then you're not going to hang around, sort of holding U.S. treasuries, which are going down. And then, of course, you've got the portfolio effect. Why is it that foreigners hold U.S. Equities? Well, there is only one reason, and that is that they have diversified their portfolios into something which they think is going to give them a profit. As soon as that profit potential disappears, guess what? You've automatically got about $14 trillion worth of potential selling overhanging the market. Now, obviously, they don't all just sort of run out and sell at the same time, but you can see the effect on sentiment once interest rates start rising, undermining the bond markets, and therefore undermining equity markets. So it's against, I mean, we started this, you were raising the question about funding. How is the Fed going to fund the U.S. Treasury debt in this situation? Well, I mean, I think I have to say that with the foreigners turned sellers, it's going to be extremely difficult. And what it means is that it will need a reappraisal of bond yields, like far higher bond yields, in order to attract foreign funds back into the U.S. Treasury market.
Yeah.
But your problem is, if you do that, you collapse the equity market. And, there's about, as I said earlier, there's about $14 trillion worth of foreign interest in U.S. equities, which, is not going to like the situation at all. The Fed is going to end up in a horrible great bind. Now, at the moment, they've turned around and said, we'll consider tapering maybe from November, maybe from whatever.
Yeah.
But, what they've done in the past is support the market through enhanced QE. I mean, mm-hmm. this is what they did back in March last year. Now, if they're going to try and, if they're going to preserve the so-called wealth effect, then they're going to have to increase QE. But again, what does that do to the dollar? The foreigners are going to run scared, certainly from fixed interest if that happens.
Yeah.
So, the magic, if you like, of creating this fear of missing out because the Fed is underwriting the market, I think could turn very much against the Fed, and they're going to have enormous difficulties, I think, navigating their way through this.
Mm-hmm. Well, not only does it undermine the equity market, rising interest rates, but if interest rates rise with $30 trillion of debt, it's going to really increase the amount of red ink at the Fed, at the U.S. Government, red ink as well. So it seems to me, you know, Danielle DiMartino Booth said last week in an interview, she said something like the Fed can't afford to raise interest rates because of the slowing economy, but it cannot afford not to because of the rising inflation rates. So with just a couple of minutes left here yet, Alistair, inflation, I don't think you believe it's transitory. I think you think we're in a systemic spiral kind of a situation where it has to almost feed on itself, unless the Fed can bite the bullet, as Paul Volcker did in 1980, which I think nobody believes is possible at this stage. What are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts, you've pretty well echoed them. I think Ms. DiMartino is absolutely right in what she says. There's a huge, great dilemma coming up, which we've just discussed. I mean, the big question is that the Fed has got, at the end of the day, has got to make a choice. Is it going to protect the dollar, or is it going to protect the markets, financial assets, the wealth effect domestically? And I think it's probably going to end up trying to sort of steer a course somewhere between the two and satisfying neither objective. I think that's a real possibility. Of course, you know, the problems we have on the supply side, you know, with lack of product, logistics, lack of labor, you know, rising commodity prices and all the rest of it, you know, that is threatening to make consumers bring forward their purchases even more, which lowers the purchasing power of the currency and runs the risk of destroying eventually the purchasing power of the currency entirely.
No. And then, I mean, people start to exit the treasury market. The treasury market is absolutely enormous. It's far bigger than the equity market, and far, far, far bigger than the precious metals markets, right? So if there's an exit from the treasury markets and money starts to flow into some of these other places, I mean, especially the precious metals markets, let's say that interest rates continue to rise and there's an exit from the equity markets. I mean, Michael Oliver was talking in the first segment today about the municipal bond markets and some of these markets that the Fed had been into and now they're pulling away from, and those rates are starting to rise. I mean, it's a mess.
Yeah, it is. And there is another aspect which we don't have time to talk about, mm-hmm. and that is that investing institutions seem to be buying into Bitcoin rather than gold. Uh-huh. I mean, they haven't got the plot. Bear in mind that it's 50 years since the U.S. government decided to try and replace gold with the dollar as the reserve currency. So nobody in the system, I mean, it covers the complete career of everybody in the financial system, apart mm-hmm. from a few old guys like you and me.
Yeah, exactly. So to what extent, I mean, just real quickly here, to what extent do you think Bitcoin is really crowding, is having an impact on the price of gold?
Well, there's no doubt that some buying that would go into gold is actually going into Bitcoin. But it's quite complex because it's going, I think, more into Bitcoin futures now. Regulated funds got to go that route. Wow. So it's rather like, expanding the supply through printing paper, if you like, rather than buying Bitcoin itself. So I have no doubt that, they could drive Bitcoin higher. But, I mean, this is one for speculation. It's not for people who just want out of the fiat money system and want to protect themselves.
We'll have to discuss that another day. We're out of time. Alistair, thank you so much for being with us again. It's always great to have you. Thank you much.
My pleasure, Jay.
All right, folks. Well, that's it for this week. Next week, John Rubino will be with me once again, and Eric Coffin and Gwen Preston of the Metals Investor Forum will also join me. Until then, goodbye, and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Labrador Gold is an exploration company focused on its flagship Kingsway project, located in central Newfoundland Gold District. Labrador Gold's first phase drilling program has successfully identified high-grade gold mineralization, including a 3.6-meter intercept, grading 20.6 grams per ton gold, and 1.85 meters, grading 50.38 gram per ton gold. The company has approximately $35 million in the treasury and is led by a world-class team of CEO Roger Moss and technical advisors Sean Ryan and Quentin Henney.